Smart litigators find winning arguments faster with Bloomberg Law. Our market-leading docket coverage has AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expanded state court coverage. And that's not all. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.
Welcome to Cases and Controversies, a Supreme Court podcast by Bloomberg Law. I'm Kimberly Robinson.
And I'm Cases and Controversies producer David Schultz.
Across the street from where a group of Donald Trump supporters broke into the Capitol on January 6, 2021, the justices will consider whether the Justice Department went too far in charging some rioters with an Enron-era statute intended to criminalize evidence destruction. The case, Fisher versus United States, will be heard by the justices on April 16th. Joining us to chat about the case is Suzanne Moniak, who covers the D.C. Circuit for Bloomberg Law. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So, Suzanne, the January 6th prosecutions have been a big deal for the D.C. Circuit. Can you give us a sense of how many people have been charged in relation to the riots and where those prosecutions stand?
More than 1,300 people have been charged in relation to the January 6th riot since 2021, and that's a number that's really been continuing to grow. Mm. These prosecutions are at all stages. There are people who have already finished their proceedings, people currently serving time for them, and there are people who have yet to be charged but will eventually be charged and face trial.
Are we going to see more prosecutions? Like, are there more expected to come in the future?
Absolutely. We've been seeing in the last few months, you know, more than 24 charges filed each month. November, December, January, February. So these charges, this is continuing to grow. This is an ongoing operation for the Justice Department.
How has the DOJ and the courts dealt with this influx of cases? I mean, it seems like they're all being prosecuted here. Has there been anything like this before?
Not really. Chief Judge James Boasberg, I spoke to him for my earlier coverage of this, and he described this to me as completely unprecedented as a workload for the court. Of course, the D.C. trial court is very familiar with high-profile cases, but the workload for this is somewhat unprecedented in that it's all headed to the same D.C. federal court. It's also really been an all-hands-on-deck situation for the Justice Department and for public defender offices representing some of these defendants. There have been U.S. attorneys coming in from districts all over the country, as well as public defenders coming from as far as Alaska to represent people facing trial here.
So let's get into the statute of question in this case. I get the sense that it was meant to cover document destruction, but is being used in sort of a different way here. How has the D.C. Circuit dealt with the claim that it's being misused?
Prosecutors have used this statute that's at issue in the Supreme Court case in over 300 of the January 6th prosecutions thus far. It's a statute, as you said, that was passed in the wake of the Enron scandal that was initially with the mind of criminalizing destruction of documents that are necessary for an official proceeding. There have been January 6th defendants who've been making arguments in court, you know, for years now that this law shouldn't apply to them, that the certification of an election should not be considered an official proceeding, things like that. Generally, it hadn't been going well for them. But obviously, in this case, it's going a little bit differently. A D.C. federal judge did rule in favor of a January 6th defendant, that's Joseph Fisher, on that interpretation, saying that the Justice Department had overreached when using that statute. The D.C. Circuit reversed him in a divided decision, and that's what brought us here to the Supreme Court.
So I know you can't get into the minds of federal prosecutors, but I'm going to ask you to do that anyway. Do you have any idea why they've charged some individuals? I mean, it seems about one in four individuals have been charged with this and along with other crimes. Why did the DOJ charge it like this?
Of course, I can never fully, you know, guess what prosecutors might be thinking. But as I've said, this operation was a huge law enforcement priority and people will use the tools available to them. And I've spoken to former prosecutors about it who have pointed to this statute as a helpful tool in these prosecutions. Of course, it does carry a pretty steep sentence. So when you're, you know, adding charges to an indictment to make it a stronger indictment, this would be, you know, a tool in that toolbox.
You know, the way people have been explaining it to me is a sort of a pyramid of how the Justice Department have charged these crimes. Like, you have people who have sort of disorderly conduct. You know, they went into the Capitol or they were on the Capitol grounds where they shouldn't be. Then the second level of people who are getting charged with this crime, often along with, like, assaulting police officers. And then you have those at this top, very, very tippy top, that have been charged with seditious conspiracy. So is that how you understand sort of the way that the Justice Department is sort of divvying up the different actions here?
I think that's probably roughly correct. I think it's also worth noting, as we're talking about which cases might be affected by the Fisher decision, that yes, when I said there were over 300 cases with this charge, it does vary some in terms of how significant that charge is to those cases. Mm. There are going to be people where that, you know, evidence obstruction, or not necessarily needed for evidence obstruction charge, is maybe the primary statute that they were charged under, is maybe what's doing, giving the reason for the majority of the time that they're spending in prison. But there may be people, as you mentioned, facing more serious assault charges where that obstruction charge is not necessarily going to make or break their case, and it's just one of many on that indictment. So it's really going to vary on the impact there.
Let's get into what your story was about, which was what happens if the court rules against the government here. Do you, first off, I mean, it seems like a lot of these January 6th defendants would have to be resentenced or could be resentenced. What would happen in that scenario? Would this be just you'd have to reexamine every one of these cases?
Well, certainly not the cases where this charge wasn't at issue. But for the, I think as of February, it was about 347 cases that had involved this statute. I do think we would likely, at a minimum, see requests to reopen those cases. Resentencings would maybe be the most common if the person felt that their sentence was higher than it would have been had this charge not been used against them. Retrials are possible if somebody really felt like the inclusion of this charge had just like tainted the jury, that they just like couldn't get a fair trial because this charge was on there. I think a plea deal would be a much more difficult thing to reopen. But I think the point is that defense attorneys are going to make these requests if there's really any room to do so. If the Supreme Court really revises at all the interpretation of this obstruction statute, makes it more narrow, you know, any good lawyer is going to advocate for their client and see if there's anything that they can do to maybe reduce their sentence.
All right. So finally, I mean, we can't talk about the January 6th prosecutions without talking about former President Donald Trump. You know, he has been charged under this specific statute as well, along with others, as you mentioned, which is the case for some other people. What is this going to mean for Donald Trump?
Well, it'll certainly affect his case, just as it would affect the case of anyone who'd been charged under the statute if the Supreme Court does rule against the Justice Department's interpretation of it. I think depending how much it affects it really would hinge on how much the Supreme Court does so. Mm. You know, there are ways that they could, say, pare back the Justice Department's interpretation a little bit in a way that really doesn't affect his case. They could more severely narrow it in a way that would. And so that's just really going to depend on what the contours of the ruling look like. It may just cause a delay in his case if he were to, you know, delay has been a bit of a tactic that we've seen in Trump's criminal trials, especially as we're approaching the election, to try to push off any trial before then. And so I think that at a minimum, were we to see the Supreme Court rule against the Justice Department here, we would see him try to say that his trial needs to be delayed. So, you know, can never rule that out. But of course, worth noting that it's not the only charge that Donald Trump has been charged with. So if this were to be fully removed even from his indictment, which may be even premature to speculate on, there would be other charges remaining.
Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting, too, that Special Prosecutor Jack Smith seemed to anticipate this in his brief filed in the Trump immunity case, which is going to be argued the next week. He dropped a footnote that said, look, even if you pare back the statute, we still think we have some documents that we can, you know, sort of prove up in relation to Donald Trump. So, there, you know, he's sort of anticipating that delay is going to be, you know, a tactic that Trump's attorneys are going to try to use. All right. Well, thanks as always for joining us to talk about these issues. We'll be definitely keeping an eye on that and what goes on. I'm sure there'll be a lot of DC circuit judges who are also watching this case and sort of being like, please, please don't do that. Please don't make me work hard.
Yeah. Well, wasn't that what that was kind of one of the main thrusts of your story, is that like this would be a lot of work just for the DC Circuit and the lower courts as well, right?
Yeah, when you say DC Circuit, I really think the impact here would primarily be on the DC Trial Court, mm-hmm. The DC District Court, because they're sort of the first stop for these cases. Not all of them are heading up to the DC Circuit. But of course, eventually the workload, you know, it trickles up as people have a new sentencing or something and then maybe appeal it.
Well, Kimberly, that was a great summation of what's going on in this case. But I want to take a closer look at how the justices might be thinking about this. Is there anything that we can, you know, read the tea leaves on as to, you know, how the justices might hear these cases based on their earlier rulings?
Yeah, so I think it's a bit tricky. And really, there are sort of two competing interests here that are at play. The first is a concern for sort of the ever-growing number of criminal statutes that there are and criminal liability that, you know, we all face. I think there's a famous book that says each one of us commit about 3 felonies a day. And there's been a real concern from members of the court about really wanting to pull back on prosecutorial discretion, not just because of the liability that exists, but sort of the notice that people are on, or the lack of notice really that they're on, if, you know, they have no clue that what they're doing is a crime, and yet then they get sentenced for 20 years. Now, that's a little different in this case. Obviously, you know, these people knew what they were doing was criminal. They just didn't know the exact statute. But I think the thrust of the argument is that, you know, this carries such a hefty sentence, 20 years, that, you know, there may be some people who didn't anticipate that that would be the punishment. And so...
Yeah, tell me about how this relates to a case involving a fisherman from a few years ago. What was going on there?
Yeah, so this was one from about 10 years ago now, Yates versus United States. This was a really memorable case about a fisherman who had actually, you know, caught fish that were too small, and he sort of threw them back into the water before, you know, the federal authorities could get a hold of them. And he was charged with a similar crime under this Enron-era statute.
He then launched a convoluted cover-up scheme to cover up the fact that he had destroyed the evidence. He enlisted other people, including his crew members, in executing that scheme and in lying to the law enforcement officers about it.
You make him sound like a mob boss or something. I mean, he was caught. The fish were how many inches short of permitted were the fish?
The fish were it varied fish by fish, Your Honor. But we did not. The prosecution in this case was not about the size of the fish.
And it was a really close case. It was 5-4. The justices really broke along non-ideological lines. Ultimately, the majority said that, you know, you have to look at the purpose of this statute and read it, you know, in that light. And that if you were to say, you know, take these anti-shredding provisions and apply them to a fish, that would be sort of unmoored from what Congress intended.
So is it fair to say that the Yates case was asking the question, is a fish a document?
Well, actually, you are like on the same wavelength with Justice Kagan, which is not ever a bad place to be. She actually wrote the dissent in that case where the statutory language there was tangible object. And she said, of course, a fish is a tangible object. And she cited to Dr. Seuss's one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. So, you know. You guys are doing a little mind meld there.
Great minds. you mentioned there are two ways that we can sort of glean how the justices are thinking about this. We have prosecutorial discretion, which you just talked about. What's the other one?
Yeah, so I think that's really, you know, the, you know, 6-3 conservatives' commitment to textualism and the idea that, you know, the best way to understand what Congress meant was to look at the words that they use. And if you just look at the statute, I mean, it's written so broadly that it encompasses potentially anything like this. You know, it really is written very broadly and sort of boundless. And so, you know, if you're a textualist and you really, you know, sort of thumb your nose up at like legislative history or legislative intent, then this isn't the best case for you, maybe. But, you know, again, we do have Yates, which purported to sort of not look at legislative history, but sort of look at the words in the statute to get an idea about what Congress was trying to get at. So, you know, they're competing, but I think there are some ways that, you know, a justice may be able to reconcile these. One person that I talked to sort of highlighted how hesitant the Supreme Court was to get into sort of January 6th and all the sort of political rhetoric when they were dealing with the ballot case out of Colorado. They sort of really ignored it and instead focused on sort of the chaos that would happen if, you know, Donald Trump were on the ballot in some cases and not others. And so, you know, whether or not that also comes into play, or if the justices are just looking at this as a straight, you know, statutory interpretation case, it's really hard to tell.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting. I mean, on the one hand, it seems like it'll be hard for the justices not to sort of reckon with what happened on January 6th in this case during the argument. But on the other hand, you know, they're law scholars. They are very good at, you know, focusing on the details and focusing on the law. So we'll see if they actually, you know, have a discussion during the argument about you know, what went down that day?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, you know, interesting question, particularly because I think the thinking behind what the Justice Department did in charging these cases was to really reflect some more culpability than just sort of parading around or going in authorized areas. You know, there is sort of this intent behind it, this really captured in the statute that you have to act corruptly. So, you know, that's specifically part of why the Justice Department is doing it. And so to totally divorce it from the facts of the case and just look at it from, like, you know, a technical interpretation case seems hard, but, you know, as you point out, not totally impossible for the nine.
Certainly not. And that'll be definitely something to watch out for during the arguments on April 16th.
Yeah, I think we'll get a much better idea about how the justices are thinking about this case based on the questions that they asked. And of course, the next week, they're going to be hearing Donald Trump's bid to get immunity from these criminal prosecutions. So interesting to see if that will be on their mind as well. As always, you can follow along with that and all the other Supreme Court news at news.bloomberglaw.com.
If you're a litigator, finding relevant docket filings is crucial. Pinpoint winning arguments faster with Bloomberg Law. Our market-leading docket coverage has been enhanced with AI-driven search and analytics, lightning-fast customized notifications, and expanded state court coverage. And we've substantially increased our litigation news coverage, so you'll always be in the know. Smart litigators rely on Bloomberg Law. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com today and get everything you need to secure big wins.